Erev Tov, everyone. Good evening. Erev Tov. I hope we all warm up. And a little bit. Maybe next time Michael will get it. Where's Michael? He's not here. Maybe next time we'll try to get some hot chocolate or something. If we're all freezing outside. I don't know. I want hot chocolate. If someone wants to join me, go ahead. No problem. Welcome to the third class of Basic Introduction to Halacha. As a short dropout of what we had on the last two meetings, on the first meeting we spoke about the differences between mitzvah and halacha. We said that Jews were first of all the nation of mitzvot, and then something changed, we talked about it, and we became, from being a nation of mitzvot, turned into a nation of halacha. On the second meeting last week, we spoke about the three major rabbis and writings that were actually the foundation of what is called modern halacha, or in other words, Shulchan Aruch. We spoke about the Rambam, the Maimonides, thank you very much, Vayyo. We spoke about the Rambam, Maimonides, Rabbi Moshe ben Maimon. We spoke about the Rif, Rabbi Yitzchak Alfasi of Fez, and we spoke about the Rosh, right? Rabbeinu Asher ben Yechiel. We spoke about those three amazing figures. We specifically focused on the Rambam, on the Maimonides. We spoke about the fact that the Maimonides was the first one, a groundbreaking a philosopher and halachic figure who wrote down the first end-to-end halachic book that covers all fields of halacha, from Shabbos, festivals, fasts, daily things, belief, faith, ethical issues in halacha, all the way to sacrifices, korbanot, what we called, temple, high priests, how would the high priest work on Yom Kippur, everything that we can find under Judaism, we would find in the Rambam's most influential and amazing writing called the Mishneh Torah, or Hayad HaChazakah. Yad, we said, is Yud and Daled. Yud and Daled is 14 volumes, 14 different volumes. Today, you know, first, I'm going to say what we're going to do today. How many of you are Sfaradim? Okay, we're in a minority here. We're in a minority. So we're all Ashkenazi, I see. We're going to... I'm married to one as well. Depends. Do you prefer the food of the... or I don't know. I'm Sephardic by food, but not by... not by any other thing. yeah, that's right. So, what? We're Sephardim by davening. That's far. That's not in Odom Mizrach. That's far.
Not in this shul
also. That's Ashkenazic. That's here. And the Sephard that some Ashkenazic pray, it's Sephard. It's not Sephardic. Sephard is a later version of the tefillah based on the Ari and the Kabbalah. So we can do basic introduction to tefillah. The different series. The next series. Why did I ask how many of us here are Sephardim? And I have only one here. So, Achad Lerefuah, what is called in Hebrew, is because today I want to discuss about the differences, halachic differences between Ashkenazim and Sephardim. First of all, what's that division? What is it? Why are there differences between Ashkenazim and Sephardim? Second of all, let's assume there is a division. We know there is a division. Why today? When, first of all, we have Medinat Israel, we have the state of Israel, and we have Kibbutz Galuyot, we have different Jews from different backgrounds and different countries living at the same country. Why still other differences in halacha and traditions? Maybe that's a time to build up one halacha, one tradition. Doesn't matter from what country your grandfathers came from, maybe. And maybe, or maybe not, we'll see. And second of all, let's assume we don't live in Israel. We live in Canada. All of us live in the Galus. We live in Canada. Bezrat Hashem. We're all going to live in Israel one day. Now we're, you know, the distances, the distance between Canada and Europe and the Middle East and the Far East. It's even though we're far away, everything with technology, it's so close to each other. It's not a big problem to have one halacha that can serve everyone, even though you don't live in Israel or even though you don't. You're not married to a Moroccan or a Tunisian or an Iraqi Jew. You can still follow one halacha because we all have access to sources. We all have access to rabbis. We all have access to internet, and we can just, you know, publish the first online halachic composition that everyone can follow. Why not? Why not doing so? But maybe that's a good idea. I don't think it's a good idea. Maybe. I know I'm coming, Rachel. I'm coming from my background is from computer science. So I'm all the time I'm looking for different ideas for applications and websites. Maybe that's a website. If you want to invest in it, why not? I will develop it. No problem. But I want to start with a fundamental explanation before we get into the Sephardic and Ashkenazic. When we spoke last week about the Rosh, the Rambam, and the Rif, we said those three are actually the foundation of what is called the Shulchan Aruch. What is the Shulchan Aruch? The Shulchan Aruch, some of you might heard of it, of this book, some of you might not. The Shulchan Aruch is the most important book of halachic writings ever written. More than the Rambam, more than the Arba'at HaTurim, the Tur that we spoke about last week, more than the Rif, more than the Rosh. Halachic writing, it's the most important halachic writing of all times. Now, what is the Shulchan Aruch? Let's first of all talk about the composer. As you can see here, you all have the source sheets. Rabbi Yosef Karo, or as we call him, Maran. Maran is, and there's other nicknames, as the Mechaber, the composer. Maran would be the most popular nickname to this rabbi. Rabbi Yosef Karo, he is the composer of the Shulchan Aruch. And if you remember last week, I told you about the story of a rabbi who wrote for 34 years a book called the Beit Yosef. 34 years he said and wrote down a halachic book, and then he realized that this book was too long and too complicated and no one would read it. So he decided in 10 years to write down a shortcut to the longest book that he wrote for 34 years. And this shortcut of the longest book called the Shulchan Aruch. So
it took 10 years.
Wow. 10 years is a shortcut of 34 years. All right? He lived a long time. He died at the age of 80-something. In Tzfat. All right? And back then, it's a long, long life. 80-something. Long, long life. For just to compare, well, we will talk about Zagama in a minute. Rabbi Moshe Israelish, they lived at the same time. Rabbi Moshe Israelish died at the age of 44. 43 or 44. And that was also back then. That wasn't as young. 44. All right? So he lived twice. For Rabbi, yeah, he had, Baruch Hashem, a long life filled with many books that he wrote. He wrote not only that, he wrote the Beit Yosef, which is, took him 34 years to write down. He wrote the Shulchan Aruch, which is the sum of the shortcut of the Beit Yosef. He wrote down Kesef Mishneh. Kesef Mishneh is an entire book that he wrote on the Rambam. He even though he wrote his own book of Halacha, he still wanted to open the Mishneh Torah that the Rambam wrote, and he, from end to end, he wrote down interpretation to a different book that the Rambam has written down. He did not just end up with his own book. He wrote down Kabbalah book called Magid Meishar. He wrote many, many, many books. But the most famous of all would be the Shulchan Aruch. What is the Shulchan Aruch? The Shulchan Aruch is a shortcut of the Beit Yosef, which means that the Beit Yosef was written, if you remember, upon the Arba'at HaTurim. If you can open here on your source sheets, the next page, I made this, how do you call it, the diagram called the development of halacha. That summarized everything that we spoke about last week. Let's go through from the beginning all the way to the end. So last week we spoke about the Rif, the Rambam, and the Rosh. We said those are the first three after the Talmud time who wrote down in halachic book, right? We all know that. That is 11th to 13th century. Those three books were composed into a sum up by Rabbi Yaakov ben Asher. We spoke about it. He's the son of the Rosh. And he wrote down a book called Arba'at HaTurim, the four columns. Every column, Or HaChaim, Yored Dea, Choshen Mishpat, and Even HaEzer. Those four columns, every column represents a field in Halacha. Or HaChaim represents, we'll see in a minute, Or HaChaim represents, for example, everyday life. Festivals, Shabbos, the Or HaChaim, the way we live our life. We have, after Or HaChaim, we have Yored Dea. Yored Dea is Isur and Heter, which means what's forbidden in Judaism and what you're allowed. Kashrus, for example, is there. Mikvaot, for example, the things that are about the mikveh is there. Everything that is about whether something is permitted or someone is permitted and forbidden would be in Yored Dea. Then we have Even HaEzer, the third column. Even HaEzer would be from the name, comes from the name, from the Pasuk, Ezer Kenegdo. Ezer Kenegdo was written in Bereshit about Chava to Adam. This book, Halachi book, talks about marriage and divorce. It's an entire book about this, about marriage life. Not only that, Ktubos, Yibamos, how do you deal with Ibum? everything, the chalitza, gitin, the ketubah, the marriage, how do you have the kinyan in the wedding, everything is there in Eben Ha'ezer. And the fourth column that he wrote down in Arba'at HaTorim, the fourth column, would be Choshen Mishpat. Choshen Mishpat, Mishpat is law. This is all the laws that are between Ben Adam Lechavero, between neighbors, we said, between, if you find an Aveda, about witnesses, about the Dayanim, those judges at court, how should they judge, who can be a witness, who cannot be a witness. All of this is in the fourth part. Now, this book that he wrote, called Arba'at HaTorim, he just summed up what he thought would be the conclusion, the halachic conclusion between the Rambam, the Rosh, his father, and the Rif. Now we need to understand, those three are on 200 years. All right, they were not fellows with each other. All right, 200 years, those three figures lived. And afterwards, the Rosh son, which is Rabbi Yaakov ben Asher, and you can see it in your little note, all the names that I'm giving you in this little notebook, Rabbi Yaakov ben Asher, he wrote Arba'at HaTorim, those four columns. Now, there were two, we're moving ahead to the 14th century. In the 14th century, there were two rabbis who lived in two different parts of the world. The first one is Rabbi Yosef Karo. Rabbi Yosef Karo Maran, which we just spoke about, lived in Tzfat. All right, in Eretz Israel, he lived in Tzfat, and he wrote down a book. He had Arba'at HaTorim, this book of Rabbi Yaakov ben Arosh. He had this book, and he said, wait, there is a problem. Why there is a problem? First of all, Rabbi Yaakov ben Arosh, a lot of time, he was Ashkenazi, and he did not write down the halacha that was back then in Spain. And Maran, Rabbi Yosef Karo, he came from a Spanish family. And he said, wait, a lot of the stuff that Rabbi Yaakov ben Asher wrote, they're not for me. They're not valid. I mean, I have a different tradition in my family, and we'll see it in a minute when we talk about Kitniyot. I remember last week, we had a very interesting discussion. We're going to dive into it today. What's the difference? And why between Ashkenazi and Sephardim? We'll see in a minute. And he said, for example, no. Why would he write, for example, that there are people who don't eat Kitniyot? Everyone eats Kitniyot in Sephardi communities. So he said, no, I need to write down a book from the beginning to from the first column of Or HaChaim all the way until the last column of Choshen Mishpat. I will write down a book. 34 years it took him to write down this book, and he called it the Beit Yosef. The Beit Yosef, the house of Yosef, his name was Rabbi Yosef Karo. He wrote it for 34 years, and he said this book would be the main halachic book for the Spanish Jewry. Spanish Jewry is not only in Spain, it's in Portugal and Portuguese Jews, and North Africa, and afterwards all the way to Iraq also, and Iran, even though today they're a little bit different than Rabbi Yosef Karo. We'll talk about it. They're different, they're not the same. But he said, I'll write down the book. Half the way of him writing the book, around 20 years afterwards, all the way, hundreds of kilometers, thousands of kilometers away from Eretz Israel, in Poland, in Krakow, there was a rabbi called Rabbi Moshe Iserlich. That was his name, Rabbi Moshe Iserlich. Or in shortcut, V'Rama, Rema. Rema, Rabbi Moshe Iserlich, with an Aleph at the end. And this rabbi had Arba'at HaTorim as well. He had this four Torim. And he was a little bit upset of it. Also, he was very much Ashkenazi. And he said for Arba'at HaTorim, you missed all the Ashkenazi parts of the fact. So Rabbi Yosef Karo thought there's not enough of Sephardic things inside Arba'at HaTorim. Rabbi Moshe Iserlich thought there's not enough Ashkenazi stuff in Arba'at HaTorim. So without knowing that there was a rabbi in Eretz Israel who sat down and wrote his commentary on this book, he sat down and wrote his own commentary on the book, called Darchei Moshe. Now, after he finished writing his book, he realized and he heard that there was this rabbi from Eretz Israel, which you've never heard of, called Rabbi Yosef Karo. And he has already finished and published the same book on Arba'at HaTorim just a couple of years earlier. Now, how many years it took for Rabbi Moshe Iserlich to finish his Darchei Moshe, I have no idea. We don't know how many years it took him. We know for the Beit Yosef it took 34 years, because he says that. It took him for 34 years. We don't know. I realize that if he wrote a book from edge to edge, from end to end, on all the four columns of the Shulchan of the tour of Arba'at HaTorim, it took him a very long time. And yet, when he realized there is already one book of that, he said, you know what? I'm not going to publish my book. I want one book. I don't want there to be two different books, two different masorot and traditions and fighting in halacha in the world. I will take my book, I will put it in Gniza, and only the Beit Yosef would be the only halachic book post Arbat HaTorim time. But his students told him, no, Rabbi, don't do it. Don't do it. We need your book. We want your book. There are some stuff that you disagree with Rabbi Yosef Karo. So what did he decide to do? He said, you know what? Okay, I will not throw away everything that I wrote down, but I will write a shortcut on my book on the Darchei Moshe. So people, Ashkenazi, can just open my shortcut on the book and they can compare it to the Beit Yosef. So he wrote down a shortcut. And after he finished writing a shortcut, what did he realize? That this same Rabbi Yosef Karo has just finished to write his own shortcut to his Beit Yosef. After the whole work that he's done twice, the Rabbi Moshe Iserlich has experienced that one, this rabbi from Israel, had raced him and won head-to-head and eventually won this race, yes, and published it earlier, yes.
You know, after the second destruction of the Second Temple, I mean, when the rabbi were writing the Talmud, they obviously encapsulated what it would take for, because the Jews were dispersed, there was no centralized Jewish authority anymore. Why did it become... So that was supposed to be the encyclopedia of Jewish law. Why did it become...
What, the Mishnah?
Well, the Mishnah and the Talmud.
Okay.
Why did it become important to make legumes into halakha?
To make what?
Legumes. Like, you know, why did you have to make it into halakha? Like, in other words, they put the standard of what halakha is.
First of all, there's a lot of stuff that Gemara is missing. A lot of stuff that the Talmud is missing. A lot of stuff. I mean, the Talmud, and that's what we spoke about in the first class, so I'll just make a short repetition on that. I will repeat that. That we spoke about that, first of all, the Torah became as the Torah of mitzvot. We were not into the halachot discussion. Afterwards, we started to be halachic Jews, but it wasn't as the last bullet of halachot like we have today, where you can just open a book and see what the halacha is. It was discussion of halacha. The halacha was dynamic. Even the Mishnah, which is the first book to write down the oral Torah, still Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, who edited the Mishnah, he still preserved and maintained the different ideas, the different opinions that were back then. On almost every halachic issue, he wrote down, he said that, he said that, he said that. So he wanted to preserve and maintain different opinions on the halacha. Even though that's a book which is written down, it's still a discussion. And Kal Vachomer would be the Talmud. When the Talmud was written down, it's all about discussions. It's not about the bottom line of halacha. But Jews post the Talmud time, when they had problems with halacha, they wanted to know what the halacha is. And what happened is that Jews moved from Babylon all the way to Europe. In North Africa. And not everyone could learn down the Talmud. It was very difficult. It was in Aramaic. Not everyone spoke Aramaic. They spoke French, Spanish. They spoke German. They did not know Yiddish, some of them back then. They did not know how to speak Aramaic. They wanted to know what the halacha is. What could they do? If you were a Jew back then, and you want to know how to light up the Hanukkah candles, and you don't know how to learn Talmud, or more than that, you don't have money. You don't have money to pay for a sofer, for an author to take a scroll of a Torah and write it down, because we don't have yet the print. What would you do? So the Rambam said, we need to have one book of halacha. And then there were a lot of stuff, because of cultural stuff, because of social stuff. A lot of questions rose up. And he had to write down those questions in his book. So also the Rambam talks about the thing about chitniot. It's so early. The Rambam himself in the 11th century, he spoke about chitniot. And the Gemara as well spoke about chitniot, but in a different way. Not in the same way. That answers your question?
Somewhat.
Somewhat. Somewhat is I'll buy the somewhat. So he wrote the Darchei Moshe. And after the Darchei Moshe, he wrote his shortcut on the Darchei Moshe. And then he realized, oh, Rabbi Yosef Karo has just finished to write down the same book before me. So he told his student, you know what? I will publish the Darchei Moshe. I will publish it on Harbat HaTurim. And today, if we open the Shulchan Aruch, I don't have it here. If we open the Shulchan Aruch, and I gave it to you last week, and you'll see a page of the Shulchan Aruch, you can see Beit Yosef on one side and Darchei Moshe on the other side. Not the Shulchan Aruch. If you see the Arbat HaTorim, Arbat HaTorim would be the first book, the first or second page that you have there. It says Tor, you will see, or Achaim. And you'll see Darchei Moshe on one side, and on the other side you will see Beit Yosef. They're both printed today on every edition of Arbat HaTorim that is being printed out. And he said, but for the shortcut of the Darchei Moshe, I'm not going to publish it as a book. But rather, I will take the shortcut of Rabbi Yosef Karo called the Shulchan Aruch, and I will add notes on the Shulchan Aruch. Every time I disagree with the Shulchan Aruch, I will add my own notes on the Shulchan Aruch, and I will call it the tablecloth. Why the tablecloth? Because the Shulchan Aruch is the set table. Shulchan, table, aruch. It's a set table. So he said, so I will be the tablecloth. I will complete what the Shulchan Aruch has missed. So this is called in Hebrew hamapa. Mapa is a tablecloth, exactly. So the tablecloth of the Rama is his book, his commentary on the Shulchan Aruch. And all the way up, until our days, if a rabbi has an halachic question, the first thing he would do is to open the Shulchan Aruch. Sometimes that's enough. Sometimes you don't need to open anything afterwards. It's amazing. Think about it. That was written in the 14th century. All the way until today, there wasn't not even one book who has such a massive, massive amount of power on Judaism and halacha like the Shulchan Aruch and the Rama. The meal. Fleishig, dairy, they're going to be different.
No, because they got to show a tablecloth, you have to put something on it.
So if you're an Ashkenazi rabbi, you would call your book like a gefilte fish. And if you're a Sephardic rabbi, you will call your books Moroccan fish. And if you're, it's a different, maybe they're going to be. There are a lot of halakhic books post Shulchan Aruch. For example, I wrote down, here's two of the most important ones. Mishnah Brura. That is here in Aruch HaShulchan. He called this book, Rabbi Yaakov Epstein, he called this book Aruch HaShulchan on the Shulchan Aruch. Alright? Those are two books from the 18th and 19th century. Alright? There are some books afterwards. There are commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch himself. There are different commentaries. If you'll see the page that you have from last week, you'll see different cubes around, just like a Gemara page. Like we have Rashi and Tosfot, we will have Taz, we will have Magen Avraham, we will have a lot of different rabbis surrounding the Shulchan Aruch and explaining him and giving him why would the Shulchan Aruch say that, why would he say different than the Rambam, what's the difference? They will try to explain it because the Shulchan Aruch was it was a shortcut. It was a shortcut of the Beit Yosef, and as shortcuts are, it was only the bullets, only the conclusions of all the discussions. Now let's try to work on that. Oh, before we try to work on that, before the example. So what about Sephardim and Ashkenazim? What happened? So first of all, Jews lived in different places. First of all, Jews lived in Spanish. Jews lived in Spain. And Jews lived in Germany. And there were not a lot of connection between the Jews in Spain and the Jews in Germany. Yes?
Just to clarify again, last week you did mention you were talking of difference, or comparing and contrasting Ashkenazi and Sephardi, but you also specifically mentioned Dutch Jewry.
Right.
Is that, again?
Yeah, Dutch Jewry are their own. In some things, not in everything. They don't have their own book like the Shulchan Aruch. They will follow the Shulchan Aruch, and specifically the Rama. In most cases, they will be like Ashkenazi. They have some of their own traditions where they don't follow not the Shulchan Aruch and not the Rama. They follow their own rabbis, their own Dutch rabbis.
They basically descended from Portuguese Jewry.
Who? The Spanish Jewry?
The Dutch?
Jews, yeah. Some of them, probably. I don't know. Some of them. It depends how old you are in your Dutch roots, I assume. I don't really know when Jews moved to the Netherlands. I have no idea when that happened during time. But I assume it's very early, and some of them probably came from Spanish roots or something, and some of them preserved the Spanish tradition, of course. But basic thing that influenced on the halachic differences, distinctions between Sephardim and Ashkenazim, not only the fact that they lived far away from each other, but more than who the neighbors were. And not only who the neighbors were, who was your ruler? Who was the king where you lived? Was that a Muslim king, like in Spain back then? Or was it a Christian monarchy, like you had in the Ashkenazi, in Germany, in Poland, in Lithuania, in all those places back then? There was a huge fight between the Muslims and the Christians in Europe back then. We all know what happened to the Jews as well. We know what happened with the Christian Crusades, for example, in all the Ashkenazi countries. We know what happened too in the Spanish exile, right? Gerush Sfarad. We know what happened in the 15th century. We know that Jews suffered from both being or under the Christians in Ashkenazi countries or under Spanish or under the Arabs, the Muslims in those Spanish countries. Although in North Africa. Now, there is a very interesting Jews that were not here and not here. Now, I'm talking about Jews, for example, who were Eastern, in where today is Iran and Iraq, or even in Babylon. We said that the Babylonian Jewry, which is today the Iranian and Iraq Jewry, they're one of the most ancient communities out there. Why? Because they're there since the first temple. Since the destruction of the first temple, there were still Jews. And Ron, I think that was you who tried to see that there were four Jews, right? There's still four Jews in Iraq. They don't have a name yet, but there's still four Jews in Iraq. So what about them? What did they do with halacha stuff? First of all, they received all this very, very late. Very late. What did they have so far till then? First of all, they spoke Aramaic. So they had the Talmud. First of all, if they had a halacha question, they could open actually the Talmud.
Onkelos,
thank you very much. We had a lot of different translations, or to Hebrew and other languages, or they could just open the very ancient book that they had back then. We had Jews not only then, we had Jews northern than that, in south of what today is South Russia, which is Uzbekistan, Georgia, Bukharia, all the Bukharian, Kavkazim, the Kavkaz. What about them? They had their own tradition. We had Jews in India as well. We had Jews where? In Ethiopia. From the first temple. And they totally, we spoke about it. They were totally different in a different way. They're in a different frequency. They're not in the discussion. They did not have halacha or rabbis at all. It's a very different thing back then. We had Jews in China. There is Jewish community in China. What about them? So, first of all, still today, we don't know everything. We need to say we don't know everything about the Jews back then for the very reason that a lot of them just assimilated. A lot of them just, they lost their Jewish identity. They married outside their faith. And they forgot their Jewish identity. They did not write down a lot of books and stuff. We have some things about stories about this Jewish samurai in China, or this Jewish Spanish person who went on to look for lands and got to America. What happened to America? How come Jews came to America? Because there's these Portuguese families who went to America, to settle in America. They got all the way, I think that was Boston, where they got in, if you'll know better than me, how they got there. And they settled back then. So Jews were all around the place. But the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah, they were the core of Sephardic and Halachic division. Now let's see an example. Look please at legumes on Pesach. That's a word that I learned today. Legumes are kitniot, but please I would use the word kitniot because it's very difficult for me to pronounce. Let's start from the very early writing. I did not put everything. There's a lot of discussions, a lot of writings. I chose the Rambam, the Arbat HaTurim, the Beit Yosef. I chose the Ramah and the Shulchan Aruch. All right, let's see how it works between Sephardic and Ashkenazic. First of all, look at the Rambam. The Rambam says, there is no prohibition. This is from Mishneh Torah. We said this is very early, 11th century. There is no prohibition on account of Chametz on Passover, except from the five species of grain alone. And there the two species of wheat, being wheat and spelt, and the three species of barley, being barley, oats, and rye. But legumes, kitniot, like rice, millet, I have no idea what millet is, let's see that in the Hebrew one, dochan, okay, beans, lentils, and that which is similar to them, are not prohibited on account of chametz. Very simple, right? How can you even say that there are? First of all, we know, even Ashkenazi would say they're not chametz. We don't need to burn them. That's fine if you have kitniot at your house during Pesach. It's not a problem. You just cannot eat them. There are different halachot about that. What happens if you eat a dish, you don't know if it has kitniot inside or not. Can you eat it or not? If you are being hosted by someone who is Sephardic and he serves you something with rice, can you eat it or not? There's a lot of stuff going on. But we know it's not chametz. So we said that as well, it's not chametz. Rather, even if one needed rice, and this is what the Ashkenazim would not agree with. Rather, even if one needed rice flour and the like in the boiling water and covered it in cloth until it rose like leavened dough, it is surely permitted for eating. And this is not leavening, but rather he called sirachon, which in other words would be decay. All right? Very simple. The Rambam said, I'm writing a book. Very simple. No one would have any questions on the halacha ed. For me, until the end of generations, if you want to know the halacha, open the Rambam. But again, the Rambam was Spanish. The Rambam, we said, was in Cordova, and before that in Egypt. He was Spanish. Not only that, he had writings with Yemen Jews. We didn't talk about the Yemen Jews. We're not like Shulchan Aruch and not like the Ramah. They're like the Rambam. Yemen Jews are following the Rambam halachically. Why the Rambam? But the Rambam was in Yemen. Side story, the Rambam really helped them very much when they had their own anti-Semitism back then. He had a lot of power in the Spanish government, and he sent letters to the king in Yemen, to all the government back then, and he helped them, and not only to the government, but also to the people. To the people of Yemen back then, the Jews in Yemen, and he tried to make them happy and to, you know, to lift them up from being so because they pay respect to the Rambam, they follow the Rambam halachically. Alright? So the Yemen follow Rambam halachically. For example, a boy under 13 in Yemen families, in Yemen shuls, he goes in lane for the Torah. We know everyone can do it because the Gemara said that. But until today, if you walk into a Yemen shul, you can find an 8, 7, 6 years old boy reading from the Torah. No problem. Yeah, of course they can. The Rambam says explicitly. Why not? All right? They're following the Rambam. Now this is the Rambam. Let's see what happens a decade later. Let's see what happens about the tour. We said that the Rambam, the Rif, and the Rosh, they were summed up into this book called Arbat HaTurim, the four columns. The Rabbi Yaakov ben Harosh, let's see what he writes. He writes, these are the things through which one fulfills the obligation of eating matzah. First of all, hear the different music of how halacha is being said. The Rambam was, there is no prohibition on account of chametz and Passover, except, and look how the Arbat HaTurim, these are the things through which one fulfills the obligation of eating matzah. Now, are you talking negatively? On a negative side, what is chametz? What is not? Or are you talking, how should one fulfill the mitzvah of eating matzah? It's not only a semantic. It has a lot of other things underneath it. We don't have time to get into it. And he says, wheat, barley, spelt, oats, and rye, but not rice and other types of kitniot. Thank you. And this also do not come to be leavened, and it is so permitted to make cooked food from them. All right? Very good. And as well from other types of kitniot. But now look what happens. And some forbid eating rice and any other type of kitniot, since wheat might blend into it. First time we see it. Where did you come from? Why did he say that? The Rambam did not say that. Again, because the Arbat HaTurim had the Rosh, and the Rosh said that. And Ashkenazi Poskim, and he lived in Germany, he did not live in Spain.
They used to use the same bags for both rice and wheat.
They used it. I'll tell you, personal story. When I was in the year before I came to Toronto, when you're a soldier, you have a lot of tasks and things you need to do. You know, I was a good soldier, but there wasn't a punishment. And I had to sit down with this huge bag of rice and try to go one, you know, to look for I don't know, bugs and stuff like that. You know how many seeds of wheat I found inside of it? It's still today. In industrial rice, I don't know how it's like in Canada. I have no idea. Probably you import stuff from other parts of the world and then it can happen. But in industrial rice bags, where they use the same companies do wheat stuff. They do, I don't know, wheat or flour, and they work on rice. You find wheat all the time. They work on the same machines. They still work on the same machines.
But in most of those countries where we get our rice, China, India, Pakistan, they don't grow wheat.
Okay, good. Let's talk about that. So what about them? For example, when we came to Toronto, people told us, here you don't need to check the flour or the rice, for example. In Israel, you must check the flour before you use it. Why? Because you can find some bugs, some stuff inside the flour. All the way until today. When we came to Canada, I was told halachically, you don't, from a thing that was Rabbi Felder or something like that, don't need to check the rice and the flour in Canada. I was so surprised. How? Why not? They told that because of the cold, there is different things for you. You would not find bugs or stuff inside of it. Even if you have, they would not live. I did not understand exactly the halachic concept of it. One second, Rachel. One second. But eventually, there is difference. There are differences. All right. So I don't know about the rice here. That's a very interesting thing to figure out. Even if we would say that we don't have this concern, we'll see there's other concerns as well. But maybe this concern we don't have here. So here we see about the Turim, the tour. He says, oh, there are some who are the some Ashkenazi who forbid from eating those rice and stuff. Yes.
I'm just gonna make a comment. My parents both are from Morocco, and my mom's tradition was not to eat rice and Passover.
Because you're Moroccan.
My father's tradition was, yes, to eat one. And they come from the same country.
Right.
From the same neighborhood, from the same geography. But so, you know, we used to follow my father's tradition because that he was, you know. But my mom would never eat rice.
So Moroccan Jews don't eat rice on Passover. I can tell you that in general.
My father's
local, they did. So this is very interesting. I don't know why. Very interesting.
They don't eat
kitniot that needs to be cooked in order to eat them. That's a special thing to do. If you need to cook this kitniya in order to eat it, you're not allowed to eat it. For example, what you are allowed to eat? Chickpeas. Chickpeas are allowed. But we're Ashkenazi, we don't eat chickpeas. That's a kitniya. Other thing you're allowed to eat is corn. But you're not allowed to eat corn if you're a Moroccan. So things you need to boil them in order to eat them. Moroccan, why? I can ask Priel, my wife, or her mother, and she will tell me. But they have their own tradition.
Swells. Swells
because of the grown water. If it grows in water next to wheat, there's.
I remember they would say anything green.
Anything green.
Yeah.
I heard my grandmother told me that her father used not to eat, for example, what was it? Vinegar, in Pesach. Why not vinegar? Because vinegar in Hebrew is chometz, and chometz sounds like chametz, so they're not okay. But this is not kitniot. Okay, there's different traditions for Pesach. Pesach is Pesach. All right, but it's important to say that again. We can see that the tour added this as an Ashkenazi. But look how he finishes. He said, "However, it's an unnecessary strictness." Look what he says. However, it's an unnecessary strictness, and we don't follow this tradition. So now we have the opportunity of that. And look how the Beit Yosef, which we said the 34 years book that it took the Rabbi Yosef Karo to write down in the 15th century, on the Arba'at HaTorim, when he sums up and he gives his own ideas into it, he writes down, Rabbeinu Yerucham, and you can see here who he was, wrote, and he quotes him, "Those who prevent themselves from eating rice or other types of cooked kitniyot in Pesach, it is nonsense." Min hagstutu, look at the Hebrew. It is nonsense. And he was Ashkenazi. Rabbeinu Yerucham was Ashkenazi. All right? I don't understand why they are so strict on themselves. Maybe because they're Ashkenazi. They very like to be strict on themselves. And I don't know. That's we can talk. We should ask I don't know, someone who has research studies on cultures and can say what's the differences. And the Beit Yosef sums up and says, "And no one is worried about this matter, only the Ashkenazi." Okay? This is the Beit Yosef, Rabbi Yosef Karo. Now, imagine you're the Rama, Rabbi Moshe Isserlich, which we spoke about in his Ashkenazi. When he reads this, he has to come, right? It's like, hold me back, hold my horses, right? I have to comment on that. I have to say, I have something to say on it. And look, he does. Because in the Shulchan Aruch, which is the last part here, which is again the shortcut of the Beit Yosef, the Shulchan Aruch summed up this conclusion and says, "Elu dvarim sheyotzim bahem yedei chovat matzah." He said, "These are the things through which one fulfills the obligation of eating matzah." Again, this is how the Torah said it. He quoted it one by one: wheat, barley, spelt oats, and rye, but not rice and other types of kitniyot. And these also do not come to be leavened, and it is so permitted to make a cooked food from them. Almost like you hear the Baran Rabbi Yosef Karo say, "I will cook you if you want. I will make you a very good bowl of rice with corn, a Mexicanic bowl. You can eat it. No problem. I will make it for you." But look at the Haggah. Haggah is how the Ramah starts. On every edition, every print of the Shulchan Aruch, we have the Shulchan Aruch, which is this. And whenever it starts and says the word Haggah, Haggah means to Haggiyah, like to overread it, like to when an author writes down a book, before he prints it and publishes it, he needs to give it to someone to edit. Would be the okay, edit la'aruch probably. And he says, and some forbid it, and he gives here who forbids. The Torah says it, Hagot Maimoniot, which is a different rabbi, the Mordechai, which is a different rabbi, and the custom is Ashkenaz, and the custom in Ashkenaz, and we says in Ashkenaz it means Germany, Poland, all those stuff, Lithuania, is to be strict about this, and one should not change it. Look how angry he is. One should not change it. However, it is obvious that they do not render a cooked food forbidden after the fact if they fall into it. He says he needs to say, okay, that's forbidden. Don't change. Don't even think of changing this tradition. All right. But if they fall, you need to know. If they fall into, they're not chametz. So if they fall into something you make, it doesn't forbid it. Now, how much it doesn't know? Okay, I'm sorry. All this rice fall into the. Can I eat it now? No, so we have here the batel b'shishim, in fact, right? We know if something is a minority in a big amount of food, for example, if you have one drop of milk in a huge bowl of meat, of I don't know, meatballs, or something. It's so tiny, you can eat the meat. Diabet, all right? If it was not on purpose. Don't try to put spices of milk. Try, I don't know, like in a laboratory with an exact amount. What?
This rule doesn't apply
with chametz. You're right. This rule doesn't apply with chametz. You're right. And the seed of dill and anise and coriander, which is kuzbara in Hebrew, I realized that as well, are not types of kidneyot. Now he explains what is not. Anise is not, and kuzbara is not, dill is not, and it is permissible to eat them on Pesach, and so does it appear correct to me. He said. Now, when he said, so it appears correct to me, you can see that he really, really disagreed with Rabbi Yosef Karo's shita here. Now, this is the essence of the differences between Ashkenazi and Sephardim. Sephardim will follow the Shulchan Aruch. As clear as it is. The Shulchan Aruch said, you can eat it, they eat it. As clear as it is. The Ashkenazi who followed the Ramah. Why would the Ashkenazi follow the Ramah? Because all the Ashkenazic rabbis afterwards, after the Ramah time, said, no, we follow the Ramah because this is our tradition from home. So what made it so strong in Ashkenazic Jewry is not the fact that the Ramah wrote it down. It's the fact that your mother told you don't eat rice on Pesach, and her mother told her don't eat rice on Pesach, and her grandmother told her don't eat rice on Pesach. It's not the fact that the Ramah wrote it down. It's the fact that every generation after the Ramah continued having this tradition. So even today, we'll say, even if we'll say there is no concern of rice with wheat blended all together, if we see what is the importance of tradition, sometimes even more than halacha, we need to say that. Sometimes tradition is even more important than halacha. Why? Because if you have tradition at your home to do something, for example, for the kitniot, or for example, the Moroccan, if your father, let's say Rachel, he ate rice, right, on Pesach. So if that's your tradition at home, but you know you're Moroccan, that would be fine. You would not need to change it. Because your father did it. Why did your father do that? That's a different type. But if you know that your father, you have your tradition, his father ate rice, although you're Moroccan, ate rice on Pesach, even though the Shulchan Aruch, did not eat rice on Pesach, even though the Shulchan Aruch would say, eat it, you're not going to eat it. Why? Because this is your tradition. Even though sometimes it's going to be stronger than halacha. And it's all around the place. The fact that the Ramah, the rabbi wrote it, I hear you disagree. But the fact that the Ramah wrote it down, it's important for us as post-Kei halacha. If we have, for example, a question. Again, personal question. I got married to a Moroccan Jew. My wife, Priel, is Moroccan. Half Moroccan, half Tunisian. And how would we deal not only with kitniot? How would we deal with everything now? Right? It's a new thing. It's a new. 50 years ago, there were not as many marriages between Edot as there is today. Also, today there are difficulties in that. I have to tell you, there are difficulties in that. There are parents in Shidduchim. There are parents. Everyone can check his own idea, his own opinion. There are parents who doesn't want their child to get married with someone from a different Edah. From a different group of Jews, even though he's Jewish, no problem. Why not? Some would say, we have our traditions, we know how our festivals look like, we know how our education looks like, we know how our prayers and our shul looks like, let's continue it. Why do you need to change it and do it? No, that the grandchildren, if they're going to get married to a Moroccan Jew, and what would they do? David, would they use the Ashkenazic book, the Ashkenazic Seder, like we do today, or will they use the Sephardic one? Because if they're going to use the Ashkenazic one, where they're going to go to their grandparents' shul, they're not understand a word of what they're doing. If they're going to use the Sephardic one, they're going to go to Ashkenazic, to Shavik Fila here, they will ask Michael, where are we? What page are we, right? What are we doing here? It's so different. Some would say, and there is a sense of I would say, even logic in that. They would say, well, we love them, but why do we need that? Yeah.
You know, what's typical is, though, when you have a dominant group in a particular country, any newcomer to the group usually follows the group who's there in there. So, you know, the truth is that until 1920 or 1890, there were no Ashkenazim in Eretz Yisrael, but there were people who followed the Rambam. So why
you had the Aliyah of Talmidei Hagra. You had the Aliyah of Talmidei Hagra, what is called the Yeshuva Yashan. As I know, because my grandfather is a 13th generation in Israel, and they came from Lithuania.
But by and large, most of the rabbis who were there, like, you know, look at Tzfat, they were mostly Tzfat rabbis. Why did that not become the Nusach or the Masoret of the country, and therefore anybody who came
here. It did. In Israel, most Jews.
I know, but it's not much, but the truth is usually you'd have one. In other words, in all these countries in Europe, they had one. Why is it in Israel that you had the Ashkenazim?
Because you had those Ashkenazim, you had the Sephardim in Sephat, and they started after the Ari, they called this the Sephard. Then you had this Aliyah from other countries, and they came to Jerusalem, and they lived. All the German Jews lived together in their own community.
Yeah, but they were the newcomers. Why did they not accept the...
Because they have the tradition. Why should I change the way I pray? Why should I change the way... my rabbi told me to pray like that. Why should I change... The fact that you pray the way you pray, that's not how I grew up. Why should I change the way I pray? If I ask you now, how difficult would it be to you to wake up tomorrow morning and change to a Yemen shul? Start from tomorrow morning, dive in to say, I'll ask Michael, can you become a gabbai of a Yemen shul from tomorrow morning? Would you agree to do that? No, why not?
Why do you have
the traditions?
Why
do I not like them? They're going to give jachnun, they're going to be kabbana, that would be fine. Don't worry. You would like them.
Why can't you not do what every other Jew did when they came into a new country and they accepted them?
No, they did not accept them. What?
Most of them did.
What do you mean they agree? What do you mean? I mean, we did not have a lot of moves of between. The moving that we had was between Spain and Egypt, and then we had. Most of it was the same. We know the Egyptians, Jews, the Moroccan Jews, the Spanish Jews, the Portuguese Jews. They all today daven from the same sidur. It's called Kehilot Kodesh Edot HaMizrach. Edot HaMizrach are all the they're fine together. But what about? It's more than that. Even inside the Ashkenazi world, we do not talk about it today. We're going to talk about it next week. What about the Reformed and Conservative and Orthodox? Even inside the Ashkenazic world, even though they're the same Ashkenazi, and most of the Seder would be the same, putting aside the matriarchs and the equality of the men and women inside of it, it would be most of it the same thing. But you know what is it for a Reformed Jew to walk into a Yemen shul? But sometimes today, Ashkenazi Jew would prefer and would feel more comfortable walking to a Yemen shul, not into a Reformed shul, putting aside the section, the women's section, the egalitarian stuff. I'm talking only Seder wise. Only prayer-wise. He would feel more comfortable, one secondary, he would feel more comfortable to walk into a Yemen shul and not walking into a Reform shul. Why? There's a lot of cultural stuff in that. Sometimes if you're so into the way you were grown up, the rabbi taught you when you were at school, your father told you how he sang to you when you were a child the Zmirot Shabbat. It's not only Zmirot Shabbat. You know that in my family, we sing the different tunes. We sing the tunes that we know usually that the people sing. You know how is it in Priel's, in my wife's house? It's so different. First of all, the songs themselves are different. And even the songs that we have the same, their tunes are different. Their tunes are more Muslim. What do I mean by more Muslims? Our tunes are more Christian. They're Christian. That's not Jewish. No, we know it's not Jewish. We know it's not Jewish. In Priel's house, they don't sing this Ma'oz Tzur. They have their own tune, which is very... It's like... And I'm not saying it in a negative way. It's like hearing a muezzin in a mosque. Yeah. I'm not saying it in a negative way, because that was how they were influenced. It's a rhetorical way of, again, it will be... Ma'oz Tzur Yeshuati, Lechan Reshabeah. It's something like that. And I'm not saying it in a negative way, but again, it comes to every essence. It's not only in about Tniot. So, back to where we started. Because I don't want to exceed 11. We'll exceed in 5 minutes. Back to where we started. So what happens today? All right, all this is very nice and correct and good. The Ramah, the Shulchan Aruch, halachic difference, distinctions. What about today? First of all, it's complicated. We can have a mini-series only about that. But I'll try in 10 minutes to tell you what the general, mahalach would be in Israel these days. I don't know how it's like here today. I assume here we're like 15 years, 20 years, 30 years ago, back in time, regarding all of this. But I'll tell you, first of all, how it's like in Israel today and what I think should be, and how I intend, Bezrat Hashem, to educate my children, where their mother is Sephardic and their father is Ashkenazic, and they will go to their grandmother, grandfather, and what would happen. First of all, marriages, as we said, between Ashkenazic and Sephardic Jews are very, very common. Also, what common? No one asks what Eda you are if you're Chiloni, if you're secular. If you live in Israel, you're Chiloni. It doesn't matter what Eda you are. At all right? They don't even bother. if you are, let's go all the way from the left to the right. If you are, let's say, what is called religious Zionist, kippa sruga, all right? So most part, it would be fine. Most part, the shul are different. The rabbis are different. The halakha would be different. But because we learn at the same schools, we go to the same Bnei Akiva. We see each other. We grow up with each other. We know. I knew from when I was in sixth grade, I knew how to daven in Edot HaMizrach way. I knew how to daven in Ashkenazic. I knew how to daven in Sephardic. I knew how to daven in Edot HaMizrach, in the Iraqian and Moroccan way. So that wasn't a problem to me to get into a Moroccan family, because when I went with Priel's father to shul, I recognized the tunes. For example, Slichot in Elul, for example. I don't know how much it's like here, but the Sephardic Slichot that is start from Rosh Chodesh Elul, before Rosh Hashanah, for the whole month, it's a thing in Israel. Everyone goes to it, even though you're Ashkenazi. Everyone knows Adon Selichot. There's tunes that everyone knows and sing, even though their tunes are from Spain or from Morocco or from Iraq, even though you and my grandmother would not know it. Maybe she will today. Maybe she would not go to it. But me, the third generation, I feel like I can connect to that through the Sephardic world, and I don't feel it's something that I don't own. I think and I feel personally that's something I own. This is, let's say, the religious Zionist world, and even there, you might find differences. Even there, you might find differences. Not everyone would accept that. There are still some problems. Not everyone would agree. And it really depends. There's differences if you're Moroccan or you're Yemen. For example, Yemen's are, it's a different thing. Not talking about Ethiopian Jewish with Jews, which is a different discussion. There's a lot of racism in it. But let's talk about Sephardim and Ashkenazi. Most of the religious Zionist community would be fine with it. And yes, and you'll have a Sephardic rabbi at school, at high school yeshiva. You will, maybe your shul, if it's an Ashkenazic shul, they will have an Ashkenazi rabbi. But they have Sephardi congregants as well, members as well. And he can give halachic answers to them as well if they are Sephardic. But yet, you know, in Israel, we have two chief rabbis. We have an Ashkenazi chief rabbi and a Sephardic chief rabbi. Why? We can talk about it later. Yes, you had a question.
No, I'm just going to make a point. In Eastern Europe, they have different rabbis. They have their own little community and their own little set of rules that we follow, you know.
Right.
So it's not unusual that we have this division between Sephardim.
It's not unusual at all.
Yeah, but the nice thing in Israel is, like you say, people go everywhere. When I was a little girl in school, all the boys from my class used to come to my father's synagogue. Like, I went to regular school. There were only maybe three Sephardim. But all the Ashkenazi boys used to come to my dad's synagogue on holidays to listen to him.
Because they have what we call the chazan in Ashkenazi. Yeah. They have the paitan. Yeah. The paitan is a Sephardic chazan, and their prayer is very, very different.
And
very different.
In the Kotel, on the Slichot, like you say.
Right. The Slichot of the Kotel, they're Sephardic Slichot. They're not Ashkenazi. Thousands of people. Look afterwards on YouTube. Look at Slichot at the Kotel. Look at that on YouTube. You'll see masses, hundreds of thousands of people going there and looking.
The singing
is Sephardic, 100% Sephardic, even though you can be Ashkenazic. I totally agree with you. Let's go one more step right. Let's go into what is called in Israel the Chardali. Chardali in Israel is the Haredi Le'umi, which means you're not Haredi. It's, again, it's very different than how it goes in North America. It's not like Yeshivish or Hasidish or, I don't know, if you went to Lakewood or you're Frum or whatever you are, it's different. Very different. I don't really know how it goes here yet. But in Israel, you have Haredi. Don't even try. I did not know what the difference is between the YU and Lakewood. All right? So when I'm part of the YU Kollel. I'll cut it out from the recording. I'm part of the YU Kollel. When I came in, I had no idea what the difference is between YU and Lakewood. Lakewood and Gavoa. All right, might be, but I did not know what the difference is. And I have to tell you, all the way until today, I cannot tell what is Yeshivish, what is Hasidish, what is, I have no idea. But in Israel, which I do know, there is a group called the Chardalim. Chardalim is Haredi Le'umi. Haredi Le'umi are Haredi people religiously, but culturally, and in terms of their Zionism, they're very much Leumi. They go to the army. They're officers in the military. They're into the. They'll go to free occupations. They'll go occupations. I mean work, not army occupations. They will be. They will do everything they can in order to blend into the Israeli society. A lot of them would live what we call in the settlements in the West Bank. Not only, and they would be. I would say religiously, they would be very close to the Haredi world. They will be very strict, halachically, but in terms of Zionism, in terms of culture, it will be very close to the Israeli part. there's still some problems with marrying between different edot. Not as a Haredi world, the regular Haredi yeshivish, they quote, I don't know, world, but in their world, there's still going to be differences. Not as much. There's going to be, I know a lot of my friends who would marry them. I know that in this generation, it's even better. And the next generation have no concern. It will be 100% fine. No one would be concerned of that. Now, what happened in the Haredi world? Now, in the Haredi world, it depends, first of all, if you're Hasidic or Litvak. Why? Because if you're a Litvak, you're not marrying a Hasidic. Even though you're both Ashkenazi, you're both from Poland. You're both from Germany. You would not marry someone from Germany if he's Hasidic and you're a Litvak. And if you're a Hasidic, you would not marry a Litvak if you're both from Lithuania. They're both grandparents, went together in Auschwitz, but they're not married. They're not going to marry together. I feel it. It bothers me very, very, very much.
They don't like the hats.
They don't like the hats, maybe. They don't like the hats. So I'm not even starting to talk about Sephardic Jewry. Not even starting to talk about Sephardic Jewry. Again, Sephardic Jewry has their own Haredi, which are not going to marry Ashkenazi. More than that, sometimes the Sephardic Haredi would look at the Ashkenazi in a pity way. All right? We know today there is the Haredi, Sephardic Haredi in Israel movement that represents them is called Shas. Shas in the political, in Israeli politics, it's a party that was formed by Rabbi Ovadia Yosef, which we'll get to next week. Bezrat Hashem was the Chief Rabbi of Israel. You can find it right here. He was the Chief Rabbi of Israel, and afterwards he formed this political party called Shas, which is it's not Shas like the Gemara is. It's different between Sfaradim Shomrei Shabbat, but they changed the Sephardic Shomrei Shabbat into Shin Samech. What is what? Shin Samech? It's just Samech Shin supposed to be. Sfaradim Shomrei Shabbat. Sashash is supposed to be. Yeah, but they because it doesn't make sense. Sashash, they moved it into Shas. That's the only reason. Only for to be much more comfortable to say it. And this movement, which started not as a political, a country political thing, but they started in Jerusalem, running to the city hall, to the municipality in Jerusalem. They said, we want to open schools only for Sephardic Jews. Why? Because the Sephardic Jews were not allowed to get into the Ashkenazic schools, if you're Haredi. Now, I'm talking to you about things that not only in the Haredi world, also in the secular world. We have, and this is a way broader discussion about how Sephardic Jewry, when they came to Israel, some of them afterwards, for them the Yemen, the Moroccan, after the establishment of the State of Israel, how would they blend into Israel? And what happened in the 70s when Golda Meir, she was the prime minister, we had this movement called the Pink Panthers. The Black Panthers. Thank you, Pink Panthers. That's a cartoon. That's a movie. The Black Panthers and what they did and what happened, that's a broader discussion. I just wanted to tell you, when we talk about Sephardic and Ashkenazic and we see the line about Hitniyot in Halacha, this is nothing compared to the division and the differences culturally, halachically, traditionally, that are all the way until today in Israel. We are better today than we were 20 years ago, way better today than we were 20 years ago, and I'm sure that 20 years ahead will be even better than what we are today. That's why I'm not concerned that when Bezrat Hashem, I will raise my children, I will not be concerned at all if they will know that their grandparents don't eat kitniot, and their grandparents on the other side do eat kitniot, and in that home they would not eat, and in that home they will eat. I don't think we need to mess up the traditions. I think it's a beautiful thing to have different traditions. When you can handle both of them together, when they're not going to contradict, I don't think it's a bad thing, and I think it's a beautiful thing. And I think, culturally, not actively, but passively, one day it will blend together into something beautiful, like there is today. Prayer, in terms of prayer, in terms of cultures in Israel, it will get much more beautiful. And I think in the years to come, Bezrat Hashem. Yes.
So among the groups that you've been talking about, who follows Badat? Badat is supposed to be like the
same. Badat is a Bayit Din Tzedek. You talk about.